Hello, everybody, and welcome to our podcast, Let's Talk About Death. My name is Nick Davis. I'm a soul midwife. So in the same way that a midwife brings a soul into this world, I support souls as they depart this world. I do that on an emotional, psychological, and spiritual level. I am very blessed to be joined by two friends this evening, Catherine Macbeth, who was an oncology nurse working in intensive care, now retrained as a yoga instructor and a hypnotherapist, and also Katie Maloney, who is a GP with a specialist interest in palliative care. So why do we want to talk about death? Well, we'd like to invite you to have the most difficult, but perhaps most necessary conversation of all, that being death. It's a subject very people want to talk about. Even we find in the medical profession, it can be very, very difficult because it's the sum of all of our fears. It's the saddest of sad things and the most unavoidable human experience of all. The thing that binds us, you could say. And therein lies the paradox. Not talking about or having some kind of a relationship with death does not make it any less scary or heartbreaking. In fact, based on our experience, it may make it more so. Over the years, death has become a largely medical event, one to be avoided at all costs. And that often means people access palliative care far too late or use their last dying days chasing false hopes of a recovery rather than spending it with their loved ones and finding a way to make peace with the inevitable, or missing the opportunity to say all that needs to be said, or not finding the time to heal the wounds and rifts that occur in life. The avoidance of honest conversations about death is not kind nor compassionate nor helpful. It can leave people feeling lonely, isolated, bereft, confused, and also scared of what they imagine is to come. Families and loved ones are ravaged by doubt and anxiety about the part they need to play, what they can and cannot say and do, and so much precious time is wasted on things that really are of no consequence in the end. Honest conversations about death are actually a real act of love, compassion, and care. They are what allow the dying person, to access real choices and live out their final days as they want and need to. So finding ways to support and walk alongside those facing end of life is within the grasp of us all. It is not reserved for those with years of medical or professional training, because first and foremost, death is a human event, and as such, we all have a part to play in comforting our grieving soulmates and developing our own relationship and conversation with death. And that's very much what we would like to invite you all to do, is to have that conversation. So before we delve into the questions, I would very much like to hand over to my friends, perhaps starting with Catherine, if I may, just to give us a little bit of background on themselves, introduce themselves, and also why it's so important to them to have this conversation. Catherine.
Great. Thanks, Nick. Basically, Nick summarised what I started off originally as an oncology nurse working in intensive care. This really was a baptism of fire into the world of death, I have to say. And I spent a couple of years working there, working very intimately, one-to-one with people really struggling in those final moments, and working with families as well. Obviously, oncology strikes a chord with many people, and I'm sure many listening will have perhaps come across someone who's experienced cancer or maybe knows of somebody. These really were the sickest people in the hospital. It was a cancer specialist hospital. So when I say baptism of fire, I really do mean that. But what happened during that time was that I lost my father 2 years in to cancer. And that really set the tone for me as a young woman, and kind of embarked a bit of a spiritual awakening for me personally, and led me away from doing that work, but taught me a lot of lessons. Having had that work and all of those experiences working with people in those final moments, where lots of regret was spoken about, lots of families wishing they'd spent more time with one another, made me want to do that with my father in those final moments. So although that job was a gift, still there were shortcomings, that's the right word, in my experience of losing my father. And I'd wished that more conversations had been had as a family. I'd wished that we had spoken as a unit and we hadn't denied and ignored the real and true experience my father was actually having, instead of pretending it was all going to be okay and he was going to get out of hospital. We were so far in planning him coming home, we hadn't actually realized, although me and my brother perhaps actually had realized, we hadn't as a unit collectively had that conversation to say, we think actually he's not going to make it out. And that was really heartbreaking, because obviously, and then he died really suddenly from sepsis, essentially. And we hadn't had those conversations. So that's really the key thing there. Despite having all that experience working with death, I still wasn't quite in the picture.
Thanks so much for that, Catherine, and for sharing. And I'm sure that may resonate with many, many people. And it just goes to show, if I may observe, how death and the experience of death transcends everything, no matter what experience or job or skills or profession we're in. It is a human event which we cannot escape from and is hugely intimate and painful in varying different degrees for us all. If I may, I'll move on to Katie. So Katie, would you like to share with us a little bit about yourself and what's led you to want to have this conversation?
Thank you. Yes. Hi, I'm Katie. I am a GP, as Nick said. I've been a GP for, fully qualified GP, for about 17 years in the NHS and now private, and had an interest in palliative care and end-of-life care from the beginning of my GP career. And I'll explain why. So I just want to mention, yeah, some of my experiences with conversations about death. So in medical school, first of all, I don't think I had any experience of death, which is weird, right? 5 years at medical school, I don't think I saw a single patient die, spoke to a single relative of a patient that had died or was dying. I had nothing to do with it. I was very much protected, kept away from it, like it wasn't an appropriate conversation for a medical student to have because you were just training. So I had nothing. I then got to my junior doctor years and I worked on a stroke ward. And the first sort of death that I remember, and I do remember it because it was my first, was a lady who I had looked after having had a stroke. I'd met her relatives when they came in to visit. I got to know her really well. It was lovely. And I had the pleasure of ringing her son to tell him that it was time to bring her home and to come and collect her. And en route, while he was coming to the hospital, she had a cardiac arrest and died. And so he came onto the ward to pick her up. And the senior house officer, so the doctor just sort of senior to me, took me to one side and said, I want you to do this conversation. I want you to talk to her son because you were the last person to speak to him. It's important that you're there. I will be there. I'm there if you need me. He was very supportive, but I felt thoroughly unprepared. I didn't know what to say to him. And in all honesty, I completely messed it up. I sat down and I just had no words. I didn't know where to start. And fortunately, the senior house officer stepped in and helped me out and handled it masterfully. Like, he was a great example. But that taught me an important lesson that actually I had to get comfortable with this and I had to know where to start with these conversations. Skip forward to my GP training, and I did a stint as part of my training, which not many GPs do actually, in a hospice where doctors worked. So I was part of the day centre and ward care on the hospital, worked under some amazing consultants and doctors. And really, that's where I would say I learnt really how important it was and learnt from these doctors how to really sort of talk about death and not to be scared of it. And with relatives, with patients, just to just approach it head on. And I also learnt the honour it is to be let into people's lives at that time. Like that actually, you know, you should show it respect. And, you know, but that there was a great joy in doing that work. And it's not a word people associate with end of life care or dying, or is joy. You know, that actually it was a pleasure to be involved in these people's lives, their the patients and their relatives. And so I've continued that on into general practice, with just trying to encourage doctors and you know, and patients to have that conversation, and yeah, frequently have quite awkward conversations, or what are considered awkward, but I wish they weren't. And so I think I just want to make death something that isn't awkward to talk about.
Yeah, I think we're all in agreement there, and certainly echoing my own experience of when I lost my father and how frustrating I found it that I wasn't able to find anybody that would have the upfront conversation with us so that we could prepare and try and work out what was ahead. And of course, what you're left with is your imagination instead, which comes up with far worse things. And also just picking up on that point, Katie, about the joy, I absolutely echo that. As a sole midwife, people often say to me, that must be really difficult work. And of course, there was a level of, you know, difficulty and, you know, intense emotional engagement. But the privilege and the experience of engaging with people in pure love and compassion is one of the most priceless and beautiful experiences, really. And I suppose that might lead us to perhaps jump in at the deep end in terms of, well, where do we start? Where do we start this conversation? And maybe it should be, well, what does death look like? What does dying really mean for people? And in as far as we're able, do we know? Do we know in any way how it feels? And maybe, you know, that is the big thing, the big place where we start to try and remove some of these stigmas and silences and fear around it, because it seems to me that death is there for every single one of us. There's no avoiding death. So in the same way that the Buddha talks about inviting your anxiety in and having a conversation with your anxiety and getting to know your anxiety, being kind to your anxiety, understanding what your anxiety is trying to tell you, maybe we should take the same approach with death and see if that can't help us a little bit more from this fear-based place where we seem to be right now. So I know that's a big question. I don't know. I'm looking both at Catherine and Katie at the same time in the hope one of them may want to start answering that question.
Well, I'm going to pass this one over to the GP.
That's fair.
You know, I think maybe a good medical, you know, what is death actually defined as, Katie? Because, you know, we can look and we can read about what that is, and then maybe we could look at spiritually maybe what that looks like and from a soul midwife perspective. I mean, I can definitely chime in, but yes. Mate, you're the GP, you go for it. Fire away.
Right. Wishing I wasn't. So medically, I suppose death is the stopping of the body and the brain. So the slowing down and stopping of organs and the heart, and finally the brain and the brainstem. And that process can be quick, it can be slow, it can look different depending on the cause of death. But I think it is important to talk about what it actually looks like. And that can be a bit uncomfortable, because some of the things that you see when someone is dying are really quite unpleasant and frightening. And I don't think it's something that's depicted very often in the media. So I don't think on television programmes you see someone dying. You see them slowly falling asleep, or you see them saying goodbye and then closing their eyes, and then it's a sort of before and after shot. When actually it's uncomfortable, it's messy, it's unpleasant, it's, you know, there are stages, and but really the stages are the shutting down of the body, I would say. And as I say, that can be slow or fast. But some of the stages you might see, just off the top of my head, things like secretions. So the chest starts to get congested, and that's part of the airways shutting down and not clearing as well, and the lungs not being able to clear. So you can get a bit of a sort of rattle sound. That sounds unpleasant and like the patient might be choking, or, you know, but actually that isn't the case. It is it's a natural process. It is part of the body shutting down. The skin might feel a bit colder because the body starts to prioritize the heart and the brain. You might confusion, lethargy, it's just getting a bit sleepier, communicating less, moving less, eating less, drinking less. Again, sort of a natural sort of stopping and slowing of things. Even a sort of agitation, a restlessness. Again, it's part of the brain slowing down. And I think it's important to understand that that is just a normal, the body shutting down. They're not things necessarily to be afraid of.
Yeah, and I think that's really important, isn't it? Because if we know what to expect, then it becomes something I think we perhaps can deal with better. From a soul midwifery perspective, a more spiritual perspective, we are taught about death through the... It's actually five elements, but there's four elements in particular that are very, they're all important. So there's earth, there is water, there is fire, there is air, and then there is a fifth stage, which is when we talk about the soul and the body detaching from one another. Although I would say my experience, I have perhaps seen that earlier, but just to step back, the different stages... in a more, I suppose, non-medicalized way. Earth is very much what you would expect. It's about that loss of mobility, the grounding. You know, we might not have as much balance. We might not want to eat as much. We might not be as independent. Our body is just starting to slow down and to not do all that it used to do. And that earth element is withdrawing. Now, very often in life, those elements, you know, you might see in us all of the time, but they are iterative and you're going through them, whereas when we are seeing death, those elements are withdrawing, they're not coming back. Now, the earth element can last a little while from our perspective, but it's very much about the loss of the body moving and acting. You know, often you can see, the loss of muscles, people are eating less, so they're losing weight, they don't fancy the same food, the taste and smell can be affected. And from there, we then often see our friends move into what we would call the water stage, which, as you can imagine, can be very teary. It can be a lot of reflection, particularly if there are soul wounds or traumas, things that have perhaps been left unresolved, maybe regrets. It's also a time of reflection. It's really quite beautiful, actually, to help people replay the film of their life. And not only focus on the things that maybe they are sad about, but also focus on their joy and their achievements and, you know, falling in love for the first time, holding their first baby, all of these magical moments. It's like, you know, your favourite film, watching it over and over and over again. And that's the water stage.
I love that because medically we don't allow for the water stage at all.
Right.
Like I didn't mention anything to do with that.
Yeah.
You know, that we don't really recognise that that is part of dying as well. Yeah.
And I think that's really interesting because it's a hypothesis I worked on. And of course, I haven't got the medical science, but I suppose it's observations is that I think this processing of our feelings is so important because the more somebody can develop that relationship with death and find a genuine acceptance, I do genuinely think that it actually eases the process. And we then go from water into fire, which is often, Katie, Catherine, I think what you might see as terminal agitation, the fire has to burn. You know, some people have more fires to burn than others, but, you know, we know that it's really important to allow that fire to burn. So as a soul midwife, if people need to rage and rant at the unfairness and the anger and the fear and the frustration, whatever it is, you know, a fire actually stops burning when it's burnt everything there is to burn. So from our perspective, it's really important to allow that to happen. And that can be really uncomfortable, you know, for loved ones watching that. But I think the thing that we were taught and I see an awful lot is what's really important is movement, is allowing people to move through those phases. And from fire, we enter air. And air is the beautiful ethereal stage where people often lose consciousness, are really starting to withdraw from the human world. And, you know, we often say, you know, for it to be quite serene and quiet, because trying to hold our loved ones back, you know, our loved ones are already finding it difficult because they know they have to go. They will have reached a point where they know that this is inevitable. And very often I do hear people saying, I am ready. I am ready to now go. And that's again, is difficult for loved ones, but it's something that is actually very beautiful to see. And so the air phase, what I would always say is, if the conversations need to be had, absolutely, I see that people can still hear, because Katie, I think medically you would say the hearing is the last things to go. But the conversations and the reflections, it's so important to have those earlier in the process. So if this is a way that we can help people access and understand the stages, it would be hugely helpful, because to leave somebody until they're in air, you might not be able to get the responses and the conversations. And, you know, lots of things, yeah. Well, I'm diverging off, so I won't go there just yet.
You know, when you talk about fire, I think that's the phase that we fight, that relatives and doctors are uncomfortable with. Yeah. We want to make them feel better. We don't want them to feel uncomfortable or angry or bitter or anything. So we kind of try and medically or manage it, or just sort of tell them it's all right. It's going to be fine.
That's because we're so uncomfortable with it. We're so uncomfortable with seeing it. And there's such a collective discomfort with even just the word, the look of someone who's dying. We just can't bear it. And it's so frustrating. You know, I'm really reflecting on everything that you're saying, and thinking about my own practice as a nurse and how many of those stages are just completely, like you say, Katie, just completely ignored. Because, you know, we fill people with drugs, and obviously working in an oncology setting, people are really sick. So there's that added element of sickness, which is very painful to add into the mix, where you do need, often people do need a lot of support because there is actual physical pain involved. But ultimately, when it's coming to those last days, why are we fighting so much to keep these people alive?
Yeah, and some of the, yeah, you, one, a couple of things actually. So Katie gave me some brilliant advice. So before, I suppose just for context, I retrained as a sole midwife following the death of my father. And I often talk about it as his parting gift to me, because I didn't understand it. I found it hugely traumatic. And the realization dawned that there was no avoiding it. So I better go and get good at it and start to understand it more. But I remember talking to Katie, and I didn't know at the time he was in fire. You know, it was terminal agitation. And we found it hugely, it was so uncomfortable. It was so upsetting. And the brilliant bit of advice you gave me, Katie, was check his pulse. Check his pulse.
His
pulse is not racing, then there is a disconnect between what you are seeing and what is happening for him. And the other big thing that I wish I'd known then, but I didn't, was had I known about these elements or more about dying, I would have been able to have the conversations with the person who's dying, i.e. my dad, to say, if this is likely to happen, how do you want it to be managed? Do you want to have the drugs or not? And we can have those upfront conversations and therefore reduce the stress and the pressure that's put.
Because then it's his choice.
Yes.
And then you're empowering him, and you're empowering yourselves as a family and as a unit. And, you know, just as you were speaking, I was just, after my dad died, I read Tibetan Book of the Dead, which provided me with a lot of comfort. And this quote that just kind of sprung to mind that I got just before we came was, this world can seem marvelously. This world can seem marvelously convincing until death collapses the illusion and evicts us from our hiding place. And yeah, it just like really brings to life this, like, something in you is brought out because there's no escaping what you're seeing. And because we're not having these conversations, we're put into a state of fight or flight or freeze. Most often freeze is what I saw and what I experienced. I especially experienced
witnessing my mother go into a state of complete dissociation and not being able to process and manage what was going on, so much so that she has very little memory of that time and what grief and loss. She's got to grieve that situation of losing her partner, but also of not being able to remember. There's such a detachment. So that's kind of really, yeah, what I wanted to add to what you were saying.
I think that fire stage is the stage that's most distressing for relatives. Mm. I don't believe it's very distressing for the patient, and I wish people would say that more and be more reassuring, because I'm convinced that is really the beginning of the brain really shutting down, which means a lack of awareness. But also it means it's too late to have those conversations, too late to ask them how they want it managed. And as a doctor, we just rush in there assuming they're going to want the drugs. And in fact, I've been a big believer in managing death well medically. And it's been really interesting, Nick, as we've had more conversations and talking more about those phases, that actually it's changed how I think about managing death medically. That actually, yes, I'm more likely to have those conversations early on of, look, you know, how far do you want to go? How in an ideal world, how would you like to be managed? You know, and being more open with relatives about, look, this is a phase, this is part of things, this is how it should be. And it's the brain shutting down.
And do you know what, Katie and Catherine, as you're talking, what it made me think of, and I think particularly with the midwifery parallel, is I remember being with one friend and I could see clearly the stages we were going through, and I found myself, and I didn't know I was going to say this, but I actually found myself sat by the bedside and saying, "You're doing really well, this will pass," in the same way that a midwife would talk you through your labour. And I remember at the time thinking, wow, I hadn't even registered that was coming, but I knew, because we were in the fire stage. And I was, you know, "You're doing really well, this will pass," because, you know, death is a process and it is work. It in the same way that we labour to bring a soul in the world, we do our own labour to depart the soul from the world. And gosh, there's so many things you're both making me think about, but the other really big one is in the water stage. The water stage really needs a lot of space holding for people. And the hardest thing to do in the water stage is you have to be like the best listener in the world, which, you know, that's like me learning to run a marathon, you know, in terms of my listening skills, because people won't necessarily know what the really deep traumas and wounds and fears are. It's something that as people talk to you and you gently nudge, you gently ask the questions, you gently open the gateway, give the permission. We're not offering, you know, we are not as soul midwives allowed to offer solutions, because we cannot make this thing go away. We cannot wave some magic wand and say it's going to be okay, because the reality is, it, you know, in terms of what you deem to be okay, these norms are changing. It's not. And this can take several hours and several visits. It's not just something you rock up and somebody's able to say. And very often, you know, if you actually ask the direct question of what's the matter, you're effectively shutting somebody down straight away, because they feel they have to come with a tangible answer and they might not know. It's a bit like our anxiety or feeling we might have. And I think that's quite difficult, particularly in medical settings, to create the level of time. So the sooner we can get to people, and the sooner we can give permission to all of us to be able to have these conversations around death and to face the fact that there is an end point coming, then the more time we have to do the work, to heal, to reflect, to feel the joy, to feel the sadness, to allow the dying person to feel their own grief, to allow them to process it. And I genuinely believe it really helps them with the journey of death.
I think it helps knowing those things with having the conversation with that person, because you're right, asking the question "what's the matter" to someone who's dying seems a little stupid, you know, because, well, obviously the matter is that they're dying, you know, and you don't have a solution to that, so you can't fix it, you know. And as a doctor, that's my job, and I just would avoid asking that, because I can't fix the answer anyway. but actually having the time, and it's okay to not be okay. It's okay that there is something the matter and it is big and we can't fix it. What do you need?
Yeah. We're just obsessed with fixing things.
Yeah.
We're absolutely obsessed with finding solutions, wanting to fix people's problems. You know, we have such a complex with that. And if we can't, we feel like we've done something wrong. There's just a real lack of acceptance around, like you said, it's okay to not be okay. I don't need to do anything. I can just hear you. I can witness you in that. And I find this, there's a really powerful element of just bearing witness to someone's pain. You don't need to, someone's pain, someone's grief. You don't need to be a trained therapist, a trained, you know, doctor to witness and experience that someone is suffering. And there's this, what I perceive as this kind of, over-medicalization, institutionalization, is that right? Yeah, we'll go with it. Of us all, where we're quite dependent on a public service, we're quite dependent on this medical way of thinking, that we've lost a sense of this, well, maybe I can just bear witness to my neighbour, my friend, my father, my mother, my sister, you know, suffering. Maybe they don't just need to be sent off to someone, a therapist or a doctor, to sort their problems. Maybe we can all come together in some kind of way and support one another a bit more. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, and actually, one of the things that does worry me, Katie, I don't know how you feel about this, is very often when we see people receiving, a difficult diagnosis, and you know, this is going to be it, very often we want to reach out and we want to support, particularly if people are struggling. Maybe it's been a very quick diagnosis, it's shock, it's trauma. And I hear, you know, we need to get you some support. And I think that is brilliant. There are, you know, the most amazing therapists and counsellors and supportive networks out there. But also, if we are 100% reliant on that professional network, eventually we will run out of capacity. And we are not making it a human, community-based, community-engaged event. So if death is fundamentally a human event, then I think it would be so lovely to empower everybody to say, well, yes, there is professional support, which is absolutely needed at times, but actually a lot of what's needed is each of us to have that faith in ourselves, to be able to step forward as a fellow human being. One of the things we were taught is we cannot actually teach you every single scenario. We just can't. It's impossible. You are going to rock up and you are going to face things you have never faced before. You are going to be in positions where you don't know what to say and you don't know what to do. Yep. And the thing you have to do is you have to put your hand on your heart and you literally just have to say, what is the thing that as a compassionate, loving human being, I feel it's the right thing to do now? So effectively, what would love do now? Because we're human beings. And at our core, that's what makes us. And then I think we open up the gates of capacity because we are all there for each other.
Yeah. Having been one of maybe only a few medical professionals or support network available to a patient, it's quite a lot of pressure. And it's a huge responsibility that you feel like you can't share. And yeah, you often don't have the words either. It's not like I have some magic phrase I can say that makes people feel better. You don't. Actually, I'm no better trained than their next door neighbour is to talk to this person about what they're going through.
There's no solution.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't have one. They don't have one. And people kind of look to you as if you should have a solution or you know the thing to say. And the number of times people have come and said to me, oh, this person, you know, in the playground, they just lost their wife and I don't know what to say to them. What should I say? And it's, well, why do you think I know? I don't know. You know, actually, nothing. Just go up and say, how are you? Or I have no words. And the number of times I've gone into someone's house when they've just received a diagnosis and I don't know what I'm going to say. And sometimes all you can say is, I'm here. Speak, you know, oh my goodness, what? I don't know what to say. And they'll say it. You don't need to have, yeah, you don't need to have an answer or a solution. There isn't one. It's being comfortable with that. And we're so uncomfortable with that.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I once heard this beautiful definition, actually, of pure empathy, which is when you are faced with these insurmountable challenges, these traumatic instances, these heartbreaking situations. How can you stay in that space with that person when there are no words? How can you do that? And if you can do that, that is the physical practice of empathy, emotion. And that really resonated with me. And it might be, you know, time maybe to pose another question, if that's okay with you two, which is where I think we're going with this, which is based on our experiences, both professionally and personally, what do we think we needed as the loved ones, and what do we now think, maybe looking back, that the people we lost needed? So one of the big things that springs to my mind, what caused, maybe just to kick it off, was caused huge anxiety for a prolonged period of time, a number of weeks, was my father's loss of appetite, which started with him not wanting his favourite foods and, you know, a nausea. I mean, some of that is obviously medication, you know, to manage pain and so forth. But some of it is just, I now know the body was shutting down and saying, actually, I just don't need it. I just don't need all this stuff. I'm not, you know, it's like, what do they say? You know, don't, and this is not in any way meant to diminish or be cavalier about death, but I think it is, for me, it was a good metaphor. My mum will say to me, don't feed the roses when you go into winter, because you don't want to encourage them to grow in the winter. You feed the roses as you're coming into spring, because that's when you want to encourage them to bloom. And that was a really good metaphor to hang on to. So when the body is closing down, they're going into winter, you know, it's awesome. The leaves are falling, they're closing down. But it caused a lot of anxiety for many weeks. And my poor mum, bless her, was cooking different things every day. And I've seen it with lots and lots of other families too. And it was such a beautiful, eloquent phrase that Dr. Catherine Mannix read, who I strongly recommend and was definitely an angel for me on a very, very dark night when I picked up her book after losing my dad, and I wish I'd had it before, is that your loved ones are not dying because they're not eating. They're not eating because they're dying. And that would have saved an awful lot of angst for us. That was definitely a real golden phrase that I really hang on to.
I think so much of it is about understanding the process of dying and accepting it and saying this is allowed. Yeah, that they're not drinking because they don't need it. You know, the body is shutting down. The kidneys aren't working anyway. They can't cope with any fluids. The body knows that. Let it do its thing. You know, same with labour. Like, it is the same. You know, trust the process. And let it do its thing. And I think so much of it is about having the conversations, yeah, getting comfortable with it, so that families, patients, they feel comfortable asking, what does it look like? What can we expect? You know, so that then they know what they're going to need.
Mm. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I think that really resonated with me. My dad was a big foodie, red wine drinker, but that all just vanished for him. That's not something that highlights as like what was the kind of anxiety for me, but I really resonate with remembering that loss and feeling very sad for him that he didn't get to enjoy a glass of red wine. He just didn't want it anymore. And I thought, oh, that really sucked. That must suck. What was really, you know, what really got to me was this lack of information he had and his denial. That was what was painful for me, that nobody, and I'm not sure I was really fully present either, but nobody really sat down and had that conversation with him. You know, I was with him most of the time. It was me who took on a lot of the responsibility of being by his side. And there was just nothing. He was a bit in denial as well until really right at the end, until he was like manically trying to write, you know, a part of his will on a blind napkin. On a napkin, you know, it's ridiculous, isn't it? So that really gets to me, and I wish we had had just some brave soul come in and just give us that real empathic conversation. And that's why we're here today, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So thank you so much, Kathy, and thank you so much, Katie. I think we've covered a fair amount in this podcast. We would really, really like to be able to talk about the things that matter to you, that you would like to understand, whether you are somebody facing your own end of life or whether you are supporting loved ones and family with theirs. We are so keen to try and understand what it is, what questions, what conversations we can have to try and open this up and offer whatever comfort and peace we can. So please do reach out to us with those questions. There'll be links at the end of the podcast on how you can do this. We appreciate you listening to us so much. We really hope that we've offered you some insight and comfort with the conversation we've had today. Sending everybody much love, and take care of yourselves. Thanks so much.